And now writer William Least Heat Moon. He's perhaps best known for his travel writing and Blue Highways. Now he's got a new book of travel writing out titled Here, There, Elsewhere that takes us from Kansas to Lake Superior, from Yosemite to Japan, England, and on to Italy. Heat Moon has just wrapped up a book on writing Blue Highways that comes out next month. William Least Heat Moon hails from just down the road in Columbia, Missouri, and it's always a pleasure to have him here because I just love his work. And Bill, so good to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. It's nice to be able to talk to the people of Kansas City, my boyhood city, the one I spent my first 20 years in. And it's nice to hear accents that I recognize again.
Even mine, right? That's great. Well, let's launch right in here, Bill, because I want to ask you about your trip as a college student to Mississippi to meet William Faulkner and the good luck you had in coming across his stepson. This is a story you tell in Here, There, Elsewhere, your compilation of stories just out. And let's begin with Doris, the waitress who gave a signed copy of one of Faulkner's books to your buddy who didn't know a thing about Faulkner, and you about fell over dead when that happened. How did all that come about?
I had a week between the graduation from my senior year at the University of Missouri and the graduation ceremony, and I talked a friend of mine from St. Louis into traveling down to Oxford, Mississippi to meet William Faulkner. In my naivete, I thought that would be possible. Well, it didn't work out that way because when we got down there, we found out that Faulkner was still teaching at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He wasn't there. But his stepson, Malcolm Franklin, was there and eventually met him. But we met him through a waitress, the one you mentioned, in a cafe then called The Mansion, which happened to be the very title of Faulkner's most recent novel. So we went in to find out if Faulkner had taken the title of The Mansion from this cafe, which is a nice little cafe. And I was asking questions of the waitress, but she was fascinated with my friend and, you know, kind of looking at me out of that corner of her eye. And I kept wanting to say, he doesn't know anything about Faulkner. He's just here because I talked him into coming. He thought this would be a lark. Yeah. At any rate, he had a stammer, and he knew how to use that stammer when he was talking with women. It was very effective, and he was hitting the stammer, and so she suddenly was right with him. And she, after when we finished our meal and we were leaving, she said, "You boys come back tomorrow." We did, and she handed him a signed copy of one of Faulkner's books.
Wow!
And my heart was just all the way as far as down as it can go, and I wanted to say to her, he doesn't know what he has there. I'm the one.
Well, I kept waiting for you to say that maybe your buddy handed you the book, recognizing the gross injustice that had just occurred there.
No, he kept it, and I'm glad he kept it in one way, because when we were putting together the actual book, Here, There, Elsewhere, I wanted to have a photograph of the signed title page and of the cover of the book, and Jack still had the book, so I was able to get a copy, and anybody who looks at Here, There, Elsewhere can see what this little book looked like. But it was a powerful trip because the stepson gave us a tour around Lafayette County.
He introduced you to Faulkner's world, right?
Indeed he did, yes. Things that appear in the novels and people who appear in the novels, Uncle Betty being prime among them. So we really got what I went out for. The tour just wasn't conducted by the master, but by the master's stepson.
But the stepson wouldn't let you see one thing, which you were very interested in, and anybody would be, which was the master's office. Why wouldn't he let you see the office?
He figured that would be a violation of William Faulkner's privacy to let us in there. So we could not get in the house. We're out on the front lawn. We're on the porch. We saw Faulkner's horse. In fact, I got kicked by Faulkner's horse. We were in the barn. We couldn't get in the house. Since then, the house is a museum now run by the University of Mississippi. And people can go in and see the house. So I have been in there since, but it took me about 35 years to get inside.
Well, you know, as someone who I was out in California for a year of my life at Stanford, and I spent some time really getting into Steinbeck and his world out there, and what a thrill it was to go to Monterey and see Cannery Row and see, was it Doc Ricketts, his old place right down there on the water, and to sort of you know, get into someone's world like that, an author that you've admired so much. What a kick in the pants that is.
Well, Steve, it was just a year and a half later that I did that same trip you just mentioned to Cannery Row. It was still a Cannery Row then. It's been pretty well turned into a tourist attraction now, but it was still functioning in those days. But I haven't been over to Salinas, which isn't all that far away, Steinbeck's home city. But I understand there in the Steinbeck Museum they have his Rosinante, which is the camper that he used when he drove around the United States in the early 60s to write Travels with Charlie.
Travels with Charlie, sure.
Yes.
Well, the public library there, when I was there, Bill, they had manuscripts of some of his books. They had autographed copies of some of his books. They had all kinds of Steinbeck memorabilia that I found absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yes, indeed. I'd love to see it.
When you go traveling, Bill, what are you looking for? What's on your agenda when you set off?
Well, two things, which really end up being one, the sense of place. What is this place like? What's it feel like? And that is so much determined in unless you're into the wilds of wherever you are, whether this country or some other, determined by the people there. So I usually start out, and this was especially true in my early days of traveling, of finding people, meeting people, getting them to talk, those who would talk, some won't, and then trying to connect them with place. And that became even more obvious, I think, in my second book, Prairie Earth, which I'm sure a lot of people in Kansas City know because it's set in the Flint Hills of Kansas.
That's the last time you and I visited. We did a whole show on the 20th anniversary of the publication of that book, which is just one of my all-time favorites. Just an absolutely tremendous achievement, Bill.
Indeed we did. I'm happy to report to people in the Kansas City area that despite what a lot of New Yorkers and West Coast people thought, Prairie Earth has never been out of print. When it came out, people said, this is a book about Kansas. Who wants to know about Kansas? But now for, coming up to 23 years, I think, the book is still in print. Readers are still finding it. And I think it's a wonderful compliment, maybe that's the word, to people of the central Midwest and our lives in this area.
People will want to know, Bill, do you get back out to the Flint Hills? Do you ever have a chance to go out and spend time and just sort of relax in the area as opposed to having to worry about writing something about it?
Well, yes, I've been out there twice in 2013. Mm. I've been helping out a group there called Pioneer Bluffs, which has a nice I'm not sure what to call it, a museum, an art center with a strong environmental focus about life on the prairie. And I've been out there a couple, three times to talk to the people there. We have a meeting in an old barn. And it's just fine to get back and see Chase County. Cottonwood Falls is so much different now in many ways from when I was writing about it in the early 80s. There's one of the best hotels in Kansas is in Cottonwood Falls now. So I stay in that hotel in the days when I was sleeping in a truck out there. it's a little more pleasant these days.
a little better, isn't it? Well, let me try to connect Prairie Earth and another new book you have coming out shortly, which is a book on writing blue highways. The book is titled just that, Writing Blue Highways, which is an autobiographical look at how the years after you came back from your trip that you based that book on and sort of how you pulled that book together. And what struck me about the excerpts from that book I was able to read last night is the struggle you went through to sort of make sense of, was it 3 months and 13,000 miles that you put on taking a look at Blue Highways to write that book, the struggle you went through to sort of pull that book together and find an organizational sort of theme to it. And likewise with Prairie Earth, you talk early in that book about what a monumental struggle it was to have spent all that time in Chase County and then sort of sit back and think, well, how do I put this story together? What's the theme? How am I going to structure this thing? You tend to take on these pretty big challenges, Bill. And as a writer myself, my knees just buckle thinking of what you had to endure as you went through the process of figuring out the organization for those very big books.
Blue Highways, the trip itself was, as you say, about 13,000 miles, a little more than that, three months to take it. And it took me 4 years to write Blue Highways, which this new book will be out, as you mentioned, in a couple of months, writing Blue Highways. 4 years to write it. Then I went into eastern Kansas in the Tallgrass Prairie, and it took 8 years to write Prairie Earth. Now, Prairie Earth is somewhat of a bigger book than Blue Highways, but not by much.
Right.
The problem was is that, and that was 774 square miles. And I got on every one of those.
You just remember the
miles.
Number, right?
Oh, I can't forget that. Yeah. So it's taking twice as long to do. Somebody else is going to have to do the math for me. Whatever 774 square miles is to some 3 million square miles in the lower U.S. Mm-hmm. The problem with Prairie Earth was, how do I put all of this together? It took me about 6 years to figure out a system to put it together. And finally, once I had that system, then I could begin writing and making sense of what I saw. And it's Prairie Earth is probably my most challenging book in that it requires some participation on the part of the reader. The reader really needs to be in there and be part of the experience of making this book. Otherwise, I'm not sure it works that well. Mm-hmm. With Blue Highways, a reader can sit back behind the windshield of Ghost Dancing, the van I used to drive around the country, and pretty well take the trip. But Prairie Earth, it's a walking book, first of all. It's primarily a pedestrian book in that way. So the reader needs to be willing to bring the mind to help make the story that comes out of those pages of Prairie Earth.
Well, let's do this, Bill. Let's take a break. When we come back, let me ask you right out of the gate, you know, as a writer, how do you endure, you know, that time when you're struggling to figure out how to put a book together, which is, of course, a lot of pressure on a writer, a lot of concern. Let's take a break. You think about it, and we'll talk about it when we come back. How's that?
You bet.
We're visiting with William Least Heat Moon about his so many of his books, Blue Highways, Prairie Earth, a new book coming out, Writing Blue Highways. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversations about the origin of World War I and the Kansas Statehouse renovations, you can find them and all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, nearly 200 years after a man arrived in Maryland as a slave from Africa, his descendant graduated from Harvard. We'll talk about the journey of that family tomorrow on our program. This hour, we're visiting with William Least Heat Moon, the author of Blue Highways, Prairie Earth, his new collection of travel writing titled Here, There, and Elsewhere. He joins us this morning from Columbia, Missouri, and I've been remiss at failing to put out our phone number here if you want to join our conversation. 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or send us an email to updodate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, Bill, I gave you a lead on the question I was about to ask when we came back from the break, which was sort of how do you handle the pressure of going not just weeks or months, but years, not knowing how you're going to string together and organize a book based on an experience you had just had. How do you handle that? What do you do?
The long answer, Steve, to it is the book itself, Writing Blue Highways. But a shorter answer that might be of some use to listeners, I know there are many out there who would like to write a book. How to survive those years of making it is, first of all, understand if you're going to make a good book, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a challenge, and there are going to be moments where you feel, I cannot continue this. Then the moments of discouragement probably are going to exceed those of when you feel you really are practically there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're expecting that this is going to be a challenge, but you believe in yourself and you refuse to give up that belief, in Shakespeare's words, if you admit no impediments, then you have a chance. One of the stories I tell in Writing Blue Highways is my partner of the time, when I stayed out too late and failed to call her and let her know where I was, got mad at me. And when I came home and we worked through the first part of that situation, I'll say, she confessed to me that she got mad enough that she thought about putting the negatives of the photographs are taken on the Blue Highways trip, the portraits of the people who appear in the book, she thought about putting those in the oven to teach me a lesson.
Oh.
Now, that's, you know, there's no way that a writer can predict that's going to happen on the way to making a book. But yeah. Those things do happen, and you've got to be willing to withstand them. And the other thing that I point out from time to time in writing Blue Highways is that there is a certain amount of luck involved. I think that Blue Highways as a book exists because of 4 years of not giving up and doing the very best I could. But there are elements of good luck in it that made it happen too.
Yep. But you say
you can't
all that
control, you can't control those. I mean, you just have to hope for those.
You say all that so easily, though, Bill, about this idea of enduring the dark times when you're struggling to put it together, and you talk about just believing in yourself and, you know, having confidence. But you know, that's easy to say, but boy, in reality, that struggle for a writer can be an exceedingly dark place to spend a lot of time.
It is indeed. I think one thing that helped move me along is that I was 38 years old when I started the trip and began writing the book, pushing 39, so I was no kid. I had 4 degrees from the University of Missouri, and I had failed to find a teaching job. That's when the job market really went to pot. So I was kind of a desperate man, and my situation was such that my parents, living in Kansas City, got so they really didn't want to talk about me much when their friends would ask, because here's a guy with all these degrees, and he has no job. Well, I did have a job. First, it was in a courthouse as a clerk, and then I was on a loading dock here in Columbia for 3 years. So you have a guy with a PhD is working on a loading dock. This is not something parents are proud of. My point here is that desperation, I didn't know where else to turn. The book was my best hope for trying to prove that I could maybe contribute more positive energy to the planet from a book than I could on a loading dock.
And maybe if you hadn't been that desperate, that book wouldn't have come out the way it did.
Oh, I think that's quite true.
Yeah.
And the implication here, Steve, is that people who want to write a book, they need to go out and make themselves desperate. So.
You don't want to do that, do you? Lots of phone calls for William Lee's Heat Moon, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Gary from Kansas City, Missouri. Gary, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is simply about, I've traveled a lot in Nebraska, South Dakota. I've lived in South Dakota, lived here many years in Kansas City, traveled to Flint Hills hundreds of times, actually, in business. And, you know, there's a romance to the Flint Hills. It's relatively unsettled compared to a lot of other states. And I was just curious, from taking the plain states from eastern Montana down to here, you know, do you still feel that the Flint Hills are special and different and in not being as settled?
Oh, indeed I do. When I go out there, it's wonderful. Let me say it this way. When I proceed from Columbia heading west, I begin to feel I'm in the real west once I hit the edge of the Great Plains, and that is most evident, particularly if you're along Highway 50, when you come into Chase County, Kansas, and the Flint Hills begin to open up. You know you're not in the same place anymore. And even though Kansas City in its early days was on the prairie, when you fly into Kansas City, you can still see signs of the prairie there instead of the woodlands that are more common, say, around St. Louis. But even when you leave Kansas City, it doesn't take long if you're on I-70 or Highway 50, which goes through Chase County, before these Flint Hills open up, and you know that this is another world. And then when you get on the other side of them, the west side of them, once again things change. It flattens out in a way, and you know you are farther into the Great Plains, but this is not the Flint Hills anymore. Now, they're a truly special place in America, and I think that's why we have the National Monument out there now. It was not there when I was working on the book. That was one of the big fights that I talk about in Prairie Earth, about how to show this prairie to the nation.
Are there any other areas north of here, you know, between here and the Canadian border, that you find are also like that?
Oh, well, western Nebraska is a place I particularly find fascinating, maybe not for to live there, but to pass through the open land out there is a marvelous place. In fact, it's such that I considered doing Prairie Earth on that area of Nebraska rather than Kansas. The reason I did not was that it was just that much farther away from Columbia and took that much longer to get to.
Sure.
Gary, thanks for the good call.
The grazing grants, too. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's go to Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a very big fan of your writing. And I had a couple questions. One of the things, especially in Prairie Earth and in Blue Highways, are these amazing conversations have these with people who just come off as so brilliant, so articulate, and you know, people who are in very what we, you know, sort of disparagingly, I think, say call you know, uninspired lives or you know, normal lives, you know, waitresses and farmers and whatnot, and they but they come off so, you know, just very articulate and just have, you know, these amazing things to, you know, observations of life. And I'm just wondering if how much of those, if those are just actual
concocted.
Well, I don't know. I'm not going to say concocted, but if they're embellished or if that's just the way that, you know, you've just managed to find these people, because I never meet them.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Bill?
Well, Paul, maybe it would help is to realize how many conversations I have with people that never make it into a book because they express themselves in ways that you're suggesting there, and that certainly is the larger number. So if you're talking for 2 days in an area, you're talking to a couple dozen people, there'll be one person in there who among the many things that she or he says is articulate, it's to the point, and all you need to do is whittle away the other things that detract from these poignant things that they say. And that's what I try to do, to keep those really sharp comments they have that really elucidate what it's like to be a human being, and let the rest of the things that we've heard again and again or that don't mean much to anybody else, just to let those fall away. Those conversations in all of my books are extremely stripped down to the very best that these people had to say.
All right, Paul.
They are not. I threw in the word concocted there, trying to help you along, but I assure you they are not concocted.
Joe from Blue Springs.
Oh, I should say this too, if I might, Steve.
Yeah, go ahead.
With all of my books, I get in touch with the people whom I've interviewed and let them see what I'm going to publish about them. They have a right to change any, correct any errors. They do not have the right to change things that might be my opinion or something else. But if I've given the wrong information or taken a tack that is clearly wrong, they have the right to let me know that. So I'm in touch with all of these people. In a way, we work together to make these profiles, as I'll call them, accurate.
Boy, that's a big time commitment on your part, Bill.
It is. It's scary, too, because I'm always afraid they're going to... Well, it has happened, and I talk about this in writing Blue Highways. There were two people, one who appears in Blue Highways, who wanted to be... who I took out for reasons I say and explain in the book, and another man who wanted entirely to disappear from the book, even though I wanted him in. So I lost two people by virtue of the fact I went back and talked to them to make sure I was telling their story accurately.
Now, I'm not sure a lot of writers would make that effort.
No, that's part of my training here at the University of Missouri in the journalism school, where we wrote a story and we had to follow up and do an accuracy check with the people we interviewed.
They read the story and they say, "Hey, did you get it right? Did you get it not right?" Yeah, boy, that's a great exercise. Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah. Joe from Blue Springs, Joe, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Well, thank you for taking the call. In your opening, I guess it might be the second chapter now, Prairie Earth, you spent considerable time in the house of Tom and Sybil, who, and I believe it was Tom who helped you understand the geology of Chase County. I, having been raised in New York City and now being attached to that family in Chase County, the culture shock of going back now almost 50 years was significant. But I wanted to just comment, you know, to let you know that they are both doing well. Tom is 86. Sybil is now 84. They're both living in the same house you interviewed them in. Tom gets out and walks the earth like he has done in the past. They've gone through, probably since Prairie Earth, two floods and have survived them because of the people of Chase County pulling together when the floods come along, and they have not really decided to move out of living in a floodplain. So that may be a test of sanity more than anything else, but that's where they are at this point in their life. And I always wanted to thank you then for the well-told story about their life and their time, you know, in Chase County, because it's they are really significant people. So thank you.
Tom and Sybil Bridge live in what used to be Saffordville on the east side of Chase County, mm-hmm. and they were among the first people whom I talked to, and generous with their time, and it helped, of course, that Tom Bridge was a geologist at Emporia State, if I recall correctly, and he gave me a picture that helped me direct the rest of my travels and my walks in Chase County.
Hmm. You know,
I'm glad to hear they're doing well. That's good news.
Yeah. Joe, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, you spend time with Prairie Earth, Bill, and you can't help but wonder pretty quickly just what in the world's happening with so much of our history in this country, these rural counties that didn't have someone like yourself come along and drill that deep into, you know, who they once were, who they are now, and you just can't help but think that so much of that's going to get lost.
Steve, this is idealism of the highest order. One of my hopes for Prairie Earth was and is that it would encourage other people to do what I was attempting to do in Chase County, and that is to go into the place and look closely and carefully the land, the people, and write as full a story as they can about that place, so that ideally we would have in this country, there are about 3,100 counties, a few more than that, that we would have a county history beyond just the basic historic facts. We'd have a personal county history of all 3,100 counties that eventually would be one tremendously huge and happy, beautiful, I should say, record of America.
Hey, has anyone taken you up on that?
It hasn't worked out that way. Well, there have been a few, but not to the degree yet that I'm hoping. And as you say, it isn't that we're running out of time, although we are running out of time for an era of people of the Second World War, the Great Depression people are pretty much gone now. So that whole story as a living piece is just about gone. Hmm. But, you know, we have the other eras coming along, so I believe the stories are still there. It's sad for me, given that I know the earlier ones, to see that disappear. But that's why we have another generation, several coming up.
Yeah. I wanted to go, before we lose you here, about some of your foreign travel that you write about in here, there, and elsewhere. Of foreign countries, you write in here that of the several ways to enter a foreign land, mine has always been to plunge into its depths and immerse myself in differences that immediately tell me home is a long way off. Why does that approach work for you?
It's more exciting than if I do a lot of preparation before I go. If I read about, let's say, the Cinque Terre in Italy, the country I've come to love very much, I get in there and some of the surprise is taken away, particularly if there are photographs. I kind of know what things are going to look like, whereas if I go in more ignorant, I get in and I say, oh, my heavens, look at this place. And it's as I say, it's one of excitement to do it that way. Surprise.
You know, I just read something about going to see, you know, the movies anymore, and one reviewer sort of suggested that people quit seeing so many coming previews, coming attractions, and quit reading so many reviews. Just go see the movie and experience it new for the first time, and just let it wash over you, and then experience it that way, which I thought was such an interesting idea.
Oh, that's the way we used to do it. Once the movies went from silence to sound, you know, the era that I kind of grew up in, there were previews, trailers sometimes we called them, that you might see if you were at a movie. Otherwise, nobody was reading reviews. I guess they were out there. But I'd go to the Brookside Theater in Kansas City or the Waldo or wherever it happened to be, and I'd walk in cold on a movie. Maybe I knew the name of one of the stars in it, but otherwise I didn't know what was going on. which means that I sat through some bad movies I might not otherwise have gone to.
That's the risk you're going to take here.
Yes.
If you listen to Steve-O here. Yeah, that's right. Well, just one final thing. Let's go to Manarola, Italy, if I'm saying that right, where shops and dwellings are stacked atop each other. You write about it so well in Here, There, and Elsewhere. Describe that for us, Bill, and why are they stacked that way?
The hills in that section of Italy, that's the Cinque Terre, up in the northwest corner of Italy. If you would look at the topographical setting of the town, without the town being there, you would say, well, you can't put a village in here. This is vertical. You got a big, huge, I'll call it a ravine coming down.
Yeah.
There's no place to build, it seems. But they found a way to do it by cutting into the hillsides to a degree and then stacking their apartments and their shops up on top of one another. So you can go into, say, in some cases, a third floor building and look out one window, and you're three floors up. You look out the back window, and you're at street level. And these are not big buildings. I mean, it happens very quickly.
Well, where are you heading to next, Bill?
Well, I'm finishing up. I say finishing up. That means a clean first draft. I'm finishing up a novel, which I can't say too much about
all
yet.
Right.
But I hope to have it out next year sometime. It's the first novel that I've written, as many listeners will know.
Right.
And we'll see if I'm able to write a novel or not. I took it on because I wanted to enjoy it. And I wanted to enjoy the ability, when I came to something I didn't know, to be able to make it up. Whereas when I'm writing nonfiction, like my other books, I can't do that. I've got to find the answer.
Uh-huh.
Well, it turns out there's a lot more research in writing, at least this novel, than I expected. You may know about that.
That's what I've read. That's what I've read. Yeah. Do you still want to get out on the road, or is that part of your life? Are you done with that?
You mean to write about?
Well, to write about, or just go out and experience it for yourself?
Oh, no. I still go out to... Q and I, who appears in my book Roads to Quaz, we haven't talked about that one, but she's a big figure in there. My wife, we still get out on the road. Oh, we're putting in probably 7,000 or 8,000 miles a year on the road, but to write about them, probably not. I want to do some different things.
Well, William Least Heapmoon's latest book is a collection of his travel stories, Here, There, Elsewhere. Takes us all over the world. He also has a new book out, coming out in just a couple of months, Riding Blue Highways. And William Least Heapmoon, Bill, such a pleasure to have you. Come back and visit us again sometime soon, okay?
I want to thank you, Steve, because, you know, I've done, I don't know how many radio interviews over the years, but it's nice to come across somebody who is well prepared. It's not always the case. In fact, it's probably usually not the case. I can name some big names here on TV and radio who, you know, just absolutely unprepared. But you've always been prepared in our interviews, and I appreciate that so much.
Bill,
and if I might, Steve, if I could say hello to the people of Kansas City, my boyhood town, it's great to be in touch with all of you again.
Such a pleasure, Bill. All the best.
Thanks so much.